That'll stay. Still switch. Don't worry.
No, that's making it.
Listen up, Umi. This is a podcast with the most Tucker. This is Forge the Narrative.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul, your host, Bale, by the Lost Souls podcast. I'm joined tonight by Adam Camilleri.
Hello. Good evening.
Tanya Gates and Red Powell.
Hey, everybody.
What up?
Welcome to the show, everybody. Thanks for listening. I invite you to subscribe if you haven't already. You may be like hovering over it, but just click it. Do us a favor. Leave us a 5-star review. We really appreciate it. Over this past weekend, there were a couple of big global events. Congratulations to the FLG team pulling off the ACO. We did a warm-up show, a pre-show, a hype show on the FLG Network, the Thursday show. If you have not subscribed to them, check us out. We'll be doing a live stream, live show, Adam and I and Alan and a couple people behind the scenes that you're going to enjoy it, doing hype shows for tournaments. But anyway, we talked about the ACO and we made some predictions for the winners. I'm going to go ahead and say we were not all right.
Yeah, how'd that go? what was your over-under on it? How'd you do?
I actually think the Death Guard were going to do a lot better than they actually did. And I'm going to say that the Death Guarders still are capable of doing it, but maybe the players had some bad luck that week.
Dang.
Yeah, my predictions, I had a bit of a cop-out prediction, to be honest, now in reflection. I did pick a Space Marine to make it, but it wasn't the Space Marine I thought it was going to be. I thought it was going to be Ultramarines run by Mr. John Lennon, who's, you know, possibly looking at getting a podium for the ITC for the year. And it was a gentleman running Black Templars, and I was very happy to see it. That's my my second little baby flag for my second favorite Space Marine chapter.
So, but yeah, Black Templar is taking what was effectively second place, but I think collapsing in the top eight.
Yeah, once it got to the cutoff and it was in the Shark Tank, Space Marines don't hold up to that many Drukhari players in a row. And yeah,
I'm not taking anything away from the player. I think getting that far with a list, I guess, what do y'all think? Do you think that it was the skill of the pilot, which is definitely a factor, or was it a combination of just shrewd list building that were effective for controlling the missions and dealing with what would be the general field of the tournament?
Why do I have to pick one or the other? Could it?
I guess fair.
Look. I think Templars are possibly the best, maybe second best or third best Space Marine chapter into what this meta was at the time of this event, which was, you know, very Drukhari centric. I call this last weekend being the last of the Drukhari bubble, where it was obvious Drukhari was the best army in the game. And moving forward from now, Drukhari have some contenders. Sisters have emerged onto the scene, and nobody can deny that AdMech is a very powerful book that can probably hold up against absolutely anything. So now they've got some legitimate contenders at the top, and we're having this bit of a reshuffle happening. But yeah, this event took place in the Drukhari bubble, and so that really skewed a lot of what you could and can't take. And so I think that's why we saw Black Templars. Black Templars have a couple of really crazy good stratagems. One of them being the denial of fallback, one of them being advance and charge, and the last one being that devout push. Now, I don't know if you guys have had much experience with it, but it's kind of game-breaking when you can use it appropriately. Do you guys know about it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, tell us why you think that.
Well, I was going to hit it over to Red, if Red can explain it probably better than I can.
I mean, well, it just goes to back to, first, I just got to say, Black Templar being mostly a melee-oriented deal, and one of the things that Drukhari also do well, which we've talked about, is, you know, melee, and the maneuverability that comes along with that. Black Templar and Devout Push, and really, I do appreciate this might come up later, but how FAQs and how GW has clarified things. Devout Push was a little, there's just a little obscurity about it beforehand. Now it's quite clear. And at the beginning of the fight phase, you essentially pile in with them, which then suddenly puts the combat. And that's huge. That can be massive in what you can do with it, whether it's, you know, getting out of an impulsor or really just how you control the fight. Because if you're just not expecting them to suddenly be 3 inches in more than they were at the beginning of the, it's at the beginning of the fight phase. So then when you actually go to select them to activate, they get to pile in again.
Let me read it. So use this stratagem at the start of the fight phase. Select one Black Templar's infantry unit or one Black Templar's biker unit from your army. That unit can immediately pile in, even if it is not within an engagement range of any enemy units. And until the end of the phase, when that unit consolidates, it can move up to 6 inches instead of 3.
So there's a lot going on there. Some people, as you see, it doesn't say your fight phase. It can be yours or your opponent's. And so what this does, it really gets into your opponent's head. At the start of every fight phase, they have to do a psychoanalysis of the entire board to see how you're going to screw with them, because you're going to, you know, it's one CP. You're pretty much going to do it every turn. I play a bunch of games of Black Templar, and I use it pretty much every turn. Every single fight phase, I'll use it. I'll bang it out. In some phases, when I don't, I'm not committing to combat, first turn or second turn, I use it as a fire and fade. I'll position myself on the side of walls 3 inches away, like sometimes it's a couple of plasma interceptors or a couple of eradicators on one side of a wall, and then I'll trigger it and I'll pile in diagonally into back inside the wall and fire and fade back and forward that way. In other ways, it's just a great way of closing distance. Let's say I wasn't on an objective. I didn't want to commit to a charge because you've got a scary unit than mine, but I couldn't get quite there. I can move, I can advance, and I can reroll the advance because I'm Black Templars. And then if I'm within 3 inches, I can just, I'm just there. Yep. It's just going to happen. I'm just on that objective.
So pilot move is three-inch move must end with the model closer to the closest enemy model.
Yeah.
So you're not just moving willy-nilly. You have to take into the consideration these types of things.
I mean, but there's to that, right? Like how you move in and how you pile in. Yes, it has to be closer, but going 3 inches slightly diagonal where you still end up, you know, let's say you were X, you know, however far away. There's just different ways.
Yeah, not your X minus 0.99 or whatever, but you're still exactly. Look, I'm not saying you can't do that. I'm saying that you still have to maintain these parameters on your movement, but you can still do what you're doing.
And then, so in other ways, it's I think Red pointed said it before, an impulsor. You think about what an impulsor lets you do. Your impulsor moves, then you can disembark your 3 inches, then you can move yourself, then you can advance. You can't charge out of disembarking from an impulsor, but this isn't charging. So you can pile in 3 inches, and if that gets you within an inch of an enemy model, you get to activate in the fight phase and you get to fight. Unfortunately, with this edition, you don't get to fight first anymore as you would have in 8th edition, because you know you haven't charged, you don't get that fight first. But there are other ways of getting around that. I usually love to take a whirlwind with me, and when I'm trying to pull that play off, I'll put flight last on the unit that I'm going to pile into, so therefore I get to hit first. And 5 Blade Guard in an impulsor for that, sometimes toting, you know, a choppy character or a Judicia to also give another aura of fights last, becomes a really potent tool in a lot of ways. Past that, it becomes a really great secondary enabler. A lot of people struggle taking things like line breaker. This thing is an incredible line breaker enabler, incredible engagement or front enabler. And past that, even furthermore away from that, it is an incredible way when you double it down. You think about that 3-inch pile-in. Thing is, though, there's a litany. And we know Black Templars are all about their litanies. That turns your pile-ins from 3 inches to 6 inches. And so having a chaplain on a bike that can zoom around like with you and enable that 6-inch pile-in instead of a 3-inch pile-in just doubles the reach of that. And then you've got the 6-inch console as well. You just get like a 1 CP for a 12-inch move, as long as your first move gets within an inch.
Building into this Black Templar deal, much like the World Eaters, which you know, you've seen a bit more of the World Eaters showcased, and I think you'll see a little bit more now that Dreadclaws can do what drop pods do. So, you know, I've talked about Berserkers before, and I've talked about them going, I mean, like what I jokingly call going Super Saiyan, right? Where like in one round of combat, suddenly they're consolidating further, they've got higher AP, they're doing more hits and everything. So Black Templar can do that too, where they just stack and build well into this fight phase, almost, you know, as much as probably Blood Angels wish they could do. Am I right, Paul?
Red did a funny. God, I love it.
So anyways, back to Black Templar and how they rock the assault phase. I mean, they really do. And when you think about their chapter trait and their ability to push out mortal wounds, and then on top of that, just some of the things that they can do between chaplains and everything else with Grimaldus and whatnot, like it's pretty fantastic. And it's not, I'm personally not surprised to see Black Templar just crushing it. I know it does seem out of left field, but
I was about to say, that's weird because you've never mentioned it before.
No, that's not true. I played exclusively against Black Templar in Crusade, and I know that I've mentioned that I've been playing against Black Templar in Crusade. That might not be the most competitive scene, but it's okay. I'll get defensive after I finish ribbing you, so it's good.
Well, I mean, I think we can now kind of, with the hindsight being what it is, look at this, some of these things and like, wow, they are really positioned very well, but I don't want to take anything away from the pilot. And this list was not on any one of our radars when we were doing our analysis of the event. And I think they really showed some generalship here.
Absolutely. And it's the right place, right time, right player, the full gamut of what you need to put together to be successful. And so he read the meta correctly, took the right things. Vanguard, Vanguard veterans, he had a couple of, a couple of Redemptor Dreads, big block of Termies, all the special characters. You want to talk about something that's crazy in Black Templars. A lot of people look at Litanies as better psychic powers. And I think that was my call of them when they came out. I'm like, why would I take a Libby anymore when I can just take a Chaplain who you don't get to interact with his powers? A lot of his powers are more powerful than the psychic powers you get available to.
Yeah, you know, for what you want to do. Right.
Yeah, for what you want to do. Obviously, much better debuffing powers in the psychic tree, especially for Space Marines. Null Zone. There's no comparison for how good Null Zone can be for you. But if you're just going to buff your own stuff, a Chappie's just better than a Libby. It just has more offensive output buffs. And so I just looked at it like that. I'm like, wow, Templars, really, they just get like two psychers. Like every single one of my Templars list starts with a Chappie on bike, a Master of Sanctity, and Grimaldus, because he's cheap and he's amazing. And so I've just got access to four premium psychic powers that you don't get to touch. You can't turn them off. You can't nullify them. You don't get to roll dice to stop them. You don't get to 4+ deny, anything like that. Just, cool, get my buffs, easy on. I like it a lot. I think they're a really, really well poised. But the thing is, I think they're well poised because I think aggressive Space Marines are coming back into the fore. I think we might see a resurgence of things like Raven Guard, like White Scars as well, off the back of this. I'm hoping Paulie, puts the Admech away, decides not to ride the wave, does the right thing, and goes back to
okay. Let me. I got to talk about Admech later on in the episode. I have an Admech army. Like, it's not like I'm jumping ship completely.
Oh, I'm just piling on with red. We're just going to make this all about laying into Paul.
I'll take it. I'll absorb this and do it. But yeah, let's talk about this, because at this last event, though, there was a kind of an exclusion on what FAQs were used and that kind of stuff. And I think it's time to, like, as soon as clarifications get published, that we start using them, like the day of, even if that means people change their list after kind of arbitrary submission date for tournaments.
What do you guys think?
One second, though. I don't even think that would have changed the outcome with the players. I just think that it might have changed the cosmetic makeup of certain lists.
I honestly, like, I'm not super experienced with tournaments. I've only been to a couple ITC tournaments because I just started before basically the world shut down. But like, how much work would that make for a tournament organizer if, like, all of a sudden on the day of, there was like changes to lists allowed?
Day of might be pretty extreme, right? But I don't think it's a ton of work on the tournament. I think it might be a big load of work to the actual players, and that may be disruptive. And that's a good point.
So in Australia, we have always and forever had a minimum of a week for list sub, a week out from the event, list is submitted. Couple of days before they go live, and you can see them all on Down at the Pairings or BCP, wherever they may be. And usually that's 2 weeks. Sometimes in team events, it's 3 or 4 weeks out that you submit your list and you lock down what you're taking. And so I haven't really experienced what a lot of people have in the States, where you don't submit a list, you just rock up with the army you want to play. And for me, that sends my head spinning for like, wow, how do you guys police each other? How do you guys keep tabs on people's lists game to game and, you know, whatnot, et cetera, et cetera. And admittedly, you know, everyone's getting on board and submitting lists now and stuff. And so it's becoming really homogenous globally about how we play the game, which is all for the better. So yeah, this isn't the same problem. I get to see this problem from the outside looking in. I think we've had a couple of poll votes and a couple of things in the community go up, especially on the Frontline Gaming organizers, or not the organizers, but the one where they get feedback from the community. They put up a post asking what people want to be the rules cutoffs for events. And I like 2 weeks. I like the same when I like 2 weeks for list sub, but you submit your list 2 weeks out from the event. The tournament organizers and maybe some select people of the community have a week to go through the lists. Either that's done privately, or that gets the whole community to go through everybody's lists. And then a week out before the event, you can adopt any last minute FAQs, whatnot, if there are any, or have people who have illegal lists change them. And then 1 week after the event, all the lists are locked in, can't be changed, whatnot. That's how I like to see things go. And I feel like that's what suited me best. But, horses for courses. I'm not here to tell anybody else how to run their events or do stuff. What's worked for you guys over there? Like, what do you guys feel is reasonable?
So in having TO, I'd say, a fair amount, there is some frustration on the TO side, but I can't say that it's, I don't think it's that rough. I think I appreciate Tanya, your opinion in regards of being a newer player yourself and in the competitive scene. And I think that there's some freshness to that. I think that there's a lot of resistance to change to people who have been doing it for a while. And I can understand their frustration. I think that you're right, Adam, with players, it being more so on their part because they do commit to something, right? They, when you go into, list building being as crucial as it is in the competitive scene that you're, or I mean, even in, if you've been building a fluff or narrative based army, and then suddenly something drastically changes. I do think that, I've talked about this before, it's kind of tough between playtesters and all, you're not always going to catch everything. And even if you bring in some of the most competitive playtesters, you're still not going to catch certain things, especially when those playtesters go back out into the competitive environment and participate themselves. There's just some different aspects to it. And so I do think that, GW doesn't really have with some actual video game models like beta testing in the same way as we understand it, where there's a public playtesting realm kind of deal. They release it, everyone gets hinged on it. There's been a, even from the age of the Iron Hands and then now into Drukhari, those are two events that I would say that they aren't so similar to say that they're completely identical, but I do think that they rhyme, if that makes sense. And then how they rhyme, there was an FAQ for Iron Hands that it was approximately 4 or 5 weeks afterwards. And I think that it definitely put them back in a more moderate position. From what people were, and that was, they changed the strat, they changed the relic, they adjusted some things. It was all fair, but I think some of that didn't come out right away, and maybe it did to a certain extent, but they didn't realize just how not good it was for the game. And so there's a lot to that. And so I guess turn it over to, Tanya, if you just in a kind of hypothetical situation, given, if you went into it and how, you're learning rules, trying to get into a competitive scene. But if suddenly an FAQ comes out that turns some of the rules that you're more comfortable with on its head, how frustrated do you think that would make you feel personally?
It's hard to say because I've only been playing since 8th edition and I've only had one codex with not a lot of FAQs or anything. So I don't really have any experience with it, but I think I've kind of just accepted this extremely fast changing nature of the game. So I might be disappointed, but I don't think that it would be unexpected, if that makes sense. So I think that I'd be able to handle it just because I would almost expect it.
Right.
Yeah.
I suppose that's a good point, isn't it? I mean, the landscape and how we play the game, how we absorb the game has changed so dramatically. You guys remember at the start of 8th edition, I have friends who ran out and bought 200 Razorwing Flocks thinking they were going to get to play with those models for a couple of years before they got fixed or nerfed or changed or the points changed. Because that was our experience of 7th edition. Once you had a release of a codex, it didn't get altered or changed until the next codex, which could be in some cases half a decade before it got changed. But, and then people got Razorwing Flocks and they spent a lot of money and they got a lot of models and they painted those models. And then I think it was sub 3 months before they were fixed. And they were, you can still take Razorwing Flocks, you just weren't going to take 200 Razorwing Flocks. And part of me was like, ha, serves you right. But the other part of me was like, wow, that would actually quite suck if I was in that person's shoes. I think now we don't have that excuse anymore. We've had 4 years of this same consistency from GW that no one should be surprised when things get altered or the goalposts get changed. I will sympathize and empathize absolutely with players. I've had models changed on me that I've spent money on, that I've painted lovingly. I think everybody on this podcast, we like having good looking models. Yeah, I like to represent a good standard of the hobby on the table when I play games. Sometimes I'm not able to because of whatever meme I'm running for a team's event. But usually I like to represent a very high standard of paint. And when I've gone and run out and, you know, let's say I bought three Redemptors before the Dark Angels codes came out. I converted them beautifully to my turn. And I was very happy with them, painted them up lovingly. And then the Dark Angels Codex came out, and they were no longer something I wanted to take as a Dark Angels player. Well, I wasn't going to take three anymore. I didn't get especially upset about that. I thought, oh, it's just a changing of the goalposts. This happens every time. Any FAQ, it happens like three times a year for everybody now.
There's a flow to the game, right?
And if you want to play this game, I think you have to accept it. I think at some level there is a responsibility on the customer, of the proprietor, of the person taking part in it, that you're going to be altered. Stuff is going to change.
When should we just, like, what's the cutoff date before events, before, like, new content at all? Either a new codex, like if a codex comes out the day of, is that too soon? Maybe not.
My last ITC tournament that I went to, we voted as ticket holders, and it was on the weekend that 9th edition was dropped, and we all decided, yep, we want to play 9th edition. So the Saturday that the edition dropped, we were playing it in a tournament. So for me, like, I think a couple days is probably enough. But again, I come into this as somebody who's only been playing in the last, like, less than 3 years. So it's something that I just accept.
I think that's a great perspective, because that, you know, most people don't know all the stratagems and all the codexes anyway.
I sure don't.
but the counterpoint to that is that when things are out for a certain amount of time, you're at least familiar with maybe the cadence of the rules. And so if someone, you know, might be mistakenly playing it improperly, you might have some frame of reference for it as opposed to just, you know, maybe just going flowing with it. Yeah, in the game for something that was released that weekend. I'm again playing slightly counterpoint here.
I think we have this off air. We made a differentiation prior to when we're talking about conceptualizing this topic. Do we need to differentiate between codexes and FAQs? Codexes are such a big change at the moment. Like, you think about what AdMech have gone through with this change of, you know, maybe you had 15 ranges in your army prior to this codex, and then your codex comes out and the power is obviously, well, sorry, not obviously, but some of the real legitimate power is in having 40, 60, 120 of these models instead. It's such a fundamental change about how these things played. I would rather not see codexes adopted like the day of this submission, the day of the tournaments and stuff. I just don't think that's fair on the players being forced to adopt it. I do like what a lot of tournaments have done, though, in asking the players of that faction, would you rather play with this codex than the old one? And then, you know, up to them what they do. But I think FAQs, and this is the red point of this out, red was raised the flag saying FAQs are different, guys. FAQs need to be taken into consideration differently. I'll hit it over to Red. You want to explain why you said that was?
Yeah, so again, we talked a little bit about the, you know, intent of the game and how it's being designed, and this all goes into the design of the game, and there is a business aspect to it. Don't get me wrong, there's something to Tanya, I think your point about, you know, the ticket holders, the stakeholders definitely have something to do when you know a TO or a event runner is they are not in it just to uphold the rules. They're also there to provide and facilitate a good time, right? And a good event. And to that point, GW's number one rule is, you know, have fun. And so there's absolutely a lot of leeway to move those things around. No one should feel, you know, that they've got to hold to a catechism of raw dogma and how it's got to exactly be. But at the same time, there is something too, and I do think that GW recently, just over this last edition or so, has done an excellent job in conveying what their intent is to certain degrees. Like, this is what we meant, you know, designer commentary and things like that. I do think that there's something to kind of the bloat that goes with it. So, you know, so Tanya, you talk about between one codex and then knowing other people's codex, I don't think the average player should really be expected to understand and know everything between all of the codexes, all the material. I think that's quite a high expectation by and large. And so does it help? Like, I absolutely think it helps. Do people get plenty of rules wrong all the time because they've tried to contain so much knowledge one way or the other? And, you know, we've all got other things outside of just memorizing tomes of 40K knowledge. Yeah, absolutely. It happens. It's okay. But going back to this point, and I'm sorry for that deliberation, but I thought it was important to explain. But I really do think that there's something to the fact that this is a FAQ. It is a correction, a change to what is there versus a codex being, as you stated, completely new. This FAQ is fixing something. And that's where I think that it could be immediately implemented to certain extents. Could it possibly change like drastically some things? Well, sure, if it was not written correctly the first time up front. And that's where I think probably the challenge, and I don't necessarily agree with this position as much, because I do admit I'm biased in regards to war game design, that clarifications are going to happen. And when they do happen, I think that they do a better job of conveying how it was meant to be played. So therefore, you should just move that set to it. But the next part being is that some people might argue, you know, they paid for it, and they paid for it under the pretenses that they were getting into it for what they saw and what it was. And then suddenly, you know, the company comes through and changes it for one reason or another. And I can understand some of the frustration with that. I will say that, you know, as you mentioned, Adam, I empathize with that. I will say, though, on the flip side, I don't necessarily sympathize. And so that's kind of the tough part to it. And as a TO, I feel that when errata comes out or FAQs, a lot of times, I do think that clarification should be immediately implemented.
You think even if it's a day before, like even if it requires a massive list change to people that you roll. I mean, I actually know this is also very subjective, and sure. I think it's easier for us to have an opinion if it's not our list that's being changed.
Well, I'd say that, and that's a great point, Paul. I think that it's huge, and that context and judgment, you should never say never, and you should not establish black and whites that, okay, we're always going to implement the FAQ at this point. I think that it should always be let's see the context and circumstance of it. If it's the moment before, there's probably a judgment call to be made by the group. And like, you know, Tanya, you said with ninth edition, the day of or something like that, you know, is everyone bought into the fact that they're going to have to deal with some frustration in that regard? You know, that's just a thing. I think that's a real thing.
It goes now. We need to do this episode on culture crafting. And maybe even like two episodes. We keep like almost like threatening to do it of like how you really convey what you want to happen at your events and what to expect. And so everyone, no matter what happens, everyone just has really an understanding of how things will play out, how things will be interpreted, how they can expect things to go. And
Can I just ask something of you guys?
Sure.
Has this ever happened to you where you've like made a list and you're like, yes, this is what I want to do, and then you have had an errata come down and you've had to change your list? Has this happened to you personally?
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, it has. Absolutely. Yeah. But because we're also filthy meta chasers. I mean, like,
right. I just look at some things and I think, well, I think that, like, I'm pretty sure that that's going to be that's going to be errated. So I'm not going to, like, spam that in my list. That's sort of how I would look at it.
So you're talking about self-censoring. There's definitely an element. That is what you mentioned, yeah? Like, censoring yourself as a player to not taking things that you think are erroneous or not meant to be.
An exploit.
It's funny you point that out, because I think I saw the best examples of that with the Drakari Codex, with that Razor Flail Succubus, the one that could get like 40 whatever attacks. After like the first couple of events with it, everyone, all the top players that I talked to were convinced that it was going to be, you know, nerfed, fixed, no longer there. They all stopped playing with it. Like I was watching battle reports, I was seeing lists updated for different events here and there, and they're like, everyone's just kind of dropping off this character wholesale because they just think it's too good and there's no way it'll exist in a couple of weeks or a month. I think you're spot on. I think that a lot of more people do that than we give credit to.
Right. It was the same thing with the jet bikes. Like a lot of like the top Drakari players are I'm just going to take them at 20 points because they're not supposed to be 10 points.
Yeah, exactly right. So you're saying we're starting to get a read of what the direction G-Dub thinks is and what we think balance is as given to us by our Games Workshop overlords.
I think that once you've been in for even just a few months, you can kind of get a feel for what is going to be fixed at some point, and then you just sort of figure out it's a matter of time. So like, can I build this list before it's errated? Yes, well then maybe I would submit that to an event. Can I not get this list built in time, or are they going to errate it before this event? Maybe I'll take something else instead.
So to that point, I mean, I can say like those are some very good examples, like with self-censoring and whatnot. Some of it, it's like some of it, and I think that this is maybe a little older an example, of course, but like I was playing Drukhari beforehand with Grotesques, and I specifically brought a this is again well before 9th edition, so excuse me for being extremely outdated.
You've always been a razor flail enthusiast.
No, I absolutely agree that you know it was pretty clear that it was not meant to go that far. But so I was playing Grotesques, and this is not with liquefiers. I was just running 20 Grotesques, and then I had a detachment, a Supreme Command detachment back when that was a thing in 8th edition, of Eldar Craft World Psykers. And this was, you know, pre FAQ, where they said Craft World Psykers could no longer, their powers could no longer benefit Drukhari.
Jinx and what you call it?
Doom.
Doom, right? And so that was, you know, that I don't think that's necessarily the same circumstance of what we were discussing before in regards of censoring, because I don't think that was necessarily as much of a exploit as we're talking about with the succubus. That was in the game, right? That was part of it. It's kind of like Inari, right? Like Inari was not an exploitation of the existing rule set in such a way that it was like tweaking the words to your advantage or something. Like that was clearly how it was meant to go. And then they made an FAQ that changed it up significantly to the extent that like people stopped playing Inari. Or like to me, I could still run 20 Grotesques, but did it synergize as well? Like, no, it just did. Moving Jinx and Doom out significantly reduced some of the effectiveness in bringing those psychers specifically. So that's maybe just a little more of a moderate example of where, like, for what you asked, Tanya, like, yes, I, you know, an FAQ has dropped and I have had to adjust from my intended army direction to such an extent. I mean, fortunately, I have multiple armies, so I wasn't as frustrated in that regard, but I could see where some people might, if that was their only one and only deal, you know, that they've been enjoying and playing with.
There's the time element of this too. So if the event changes, so if the event adopts an FAQ that radically changes what your build was, you know, do you even have the time to adjust? Can you effectively compete with the models that you have, you know, if that happens?
Sure, absolutely. And that's something that needs to be, you know, considered and appropriate considerations given by the TOs.
There's a lot of consider. So, but this goes back to like we're talking about, if you're building an event, you're taking on a lot of risk and you've got to decide what that tolerance is. And I think if you communicate to your player base, your participants, how you're going to come down on some of these issues, i.e. we're going to accept a fact 2 weeks out or a week out or the day of or whatever. And as long as you communicate that, your people will know what to expect.
Yeah.
Fair? That's another question. Fair is a charged word, and I know that. But like, what do we think the best way of going about it is?
The absolute best way of going about it is if GW was to lock themselves into a FAQ rotation. Like after every codex, literally no matter what, 2 weeks after that codex, we'll get the FAQ out. The autumn FAQ is going to be in this week. Let's not be awful and lock themselves into a day. And same for chapter approved, et cetera, et cetera. And then we can just... This is a perfect world, obviously, and this is very
that
very
might be a lot to ask.
Ever happen.
I mean, like, there's
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's an amazing amount to last, but this would be the perfect world, and this in my mind, this should almost be the goal, right? But whether it ever happens, who knows? And then everybody can
plan accordingly. Let's pretend that we're just giving advice to an organizer.
Yep, and not making wild, wild dreamscape, futuristic paradises.
Let's just pretend we're going to events and we have a preference.
My preference is, lists get submitted 2 weeks out and then they all get checked. A week out from the event, lists are locked in, any changes or modifications made then. And if no changes need to be made, no changes are made. They are what they are 2 weeks out.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah, I think that to the custodial duties of a TO to a certain extent, I know there's crowdsourcing and whatnot, but I think to... You know, having to go through verify list, validating things, I think 2 weeks is kind of a fair bar to start with and then make calls as needed from there. But one thing I'd say to event organizers is, you know, there are plenty and most, if not all of the players at your event are well-intended and are not just always out for themselves necessarily. Like it's not to villainize them by any means. But also, you know, don't let yourself get pushed into unfavorable positions that might, you know, not benefit the event or or the group as a whole. So it's just something that you need to look out for and be cognizant of, and always trying to, you know, provide that better event for everybody. But at the same time, understanding that there's, just like when you're playing a game yourself, that there's a spirit to it that you are a custodian of.
Yeah, well, as a newer player, I would kind of echo that. I would just say, just clearly put whatever you want to do into the tournament pack and then stick to your guns. Like just consistently enforce that. Mm. And like as a new player, that works great for me. But I'm pretty laissez-faire about everything.
Well said, and thanks for everyone for listening to our, was it a veiled discussion of the trials and tribulations of chasing the meta?
Well, it's just kind of the reality of the game now, isn't it? It's just how it is.
Come on. We just talked for the first opening segment about a Black Templar list, which was on no one's radar. It is not the nature of the game. We sometimes the nature of the game.
No, I don't mean that. I mean the changing of everything. Everything alters. Everything's fluid. Nothing's going to be locked in for a year, you know? I didn't mean the Black Templar list. I meant how much the game changes, how much it's altered, ever shifting, ever growing. And I like it.
When we're on the bleeding edge, you know, of whatever, I think there's a certain amount of risk in that, but what's our tolerance, and then what becomes accepted, and then how organizers handle this kind of stuff. And it's been a good talk, and I appreciate everybody's insights. Let's take a break. We're a little bit over our segment time now, and then we'll come back and we'll talk about what it's like to build Iron Striders.
See y'all. It's bad.
See y'all. Hold tight.
FTN is brought to you by Discount Games Inc. Please visit them at www.discountgamesinc.com. And don't forget to ask Jay about ways to save even more on your hobby projects.
Hey everybody, we are back. It's still got everybody with us. Thanks for tuning in and listening to that. It's an interesting dialogue, I think. It's something to consider. And I think the more I thought about it, especially during the break, I think 2 weeks is probably a fine time considering, you know, what it takes to alter a list with the like physical components of figures and stuff. And maintaining a hobby standard, if that's one of your concerns.
Yeah, I think I like always taking hobby standards into consideration with everything. I never want that to not be a thing that's part of the game.
Yeah, agreed. Speaking of hobby standards though, I do want to talk about these Iron Striders. I'd say so it is difficult. It's a little bit fiddly to assemble the legs in different configurations on these Iron Striders. And so as powerful as they are, and as many units as I'm going to remove from the table of my opponent, I feel like I've earned it.
What alterations have you made on the legs?
Alterations. No, this is just look at the instructions. It's just difficult to assemble the leg assembly. Getting them positioned in a way that is not just like a cookie cutter variant of all of them.
Yeah.
Now look, by the fifth one, I was hitting a stride and was able to do it pretty quickly. But it's a little bit of a curve.
Wait a minute. Be a pun?
How many do you have?
Total 13.
Yeah.
But some of those are the Lance.
You got some Dragoons in there as well. Yeah, good.
Yeah, some of those are Dragoons, yeah.
Good.
Yeah. Because I think you probably don't want more than you, heck, I might be wrong. Look, my list is doing pretty well, but you might want 12 of the Iron Striders. But I think like two units of three might even be worth it.
Just like half the listener base was just like, F4.
No, sir.
I don't disagree. I think they're a phenomenally powerful unit. And how deep you go with it, it's up to you. I really like MSU units of Dragoons. Three units of two Dragoons really excites me, just because I think they're one of my favorite and most hilarious like fluff units going. They're like mechanical dudes riding literal mechanical legs, pretending to be like knights, like having a lance charge. I think that's hilarious.
Yeah, they still get some play. I think you can make a case for the Dragoons. Very, very absolutely true. But I tell you, these Iron Striders have performed phenomenally. And they're not, I don't think they're overpowered. And I say this genuinely. I do think that when you start to become, to master how you layer up the canicles and you when to do certain stratagems and that kind of stuff, and then mastering the movement phase, you still have to play the game with them. It's not easy mode by any stretch. Unless you happen to roll a bunch of sixes, you know, then but how's that different than anything else?
Yeah, I don't disagree. I think I don't mind how powerful they are. I think that there need to be a few more points. They're 65, I think.
75 when you put the last cannon on.
You put the last cannon on, yeah. I feel like that's a little bit too cheap for what you get, just for the sheer potency of them. But it's not that far off. Maybe they could go up by 5, maybe they go up by 10, and you'd still take just as many because they're just that good.
See, I still think, though, it comes down to a little bit of generalship, you know, and how you use them. Because if you kind of put them out to where they can get got, you know, essentially, then you're picking them up, and it doesn't, you know, it doesn't matter how many points they are.
That's fair.
A little bit of mastery of all the things in this book, though, and they do. And the longer you can keep them alive, the better. And not that you don't need, you know, you have a lot of range and stuff with them, but still, we play a very aggressive game, and there's lots of movement tricks from lots of different armies, and if you are careless with them, they will not perform as well for them. But if you master them, you're going to do a lot of work and just be frustrating to your opponents.
What have you played against so far? How many games you had with the AdMech?
I think I'm up to 5 competitive games, a mixture of things. Some of them on the, what I would consider on the competitive side, some of them not, but they do really well against Death Guard. They do really well against Drakari and some of the other, and Marine-based armies, just general Marine-based armies. They're going to, the AdMech is going to have a field day with.
Fair. Have you guys read, or Tanya, you guys played against AdMech yet?
We're still pretty much, like, we just opened up to have people in our house yesterday.
Mm.
So, no.
Really? Yeah, no. I can't say I've gotten an opportunity. There was some folks playing smaller games, but I have not gotten a full-on competitive experience with AdMech yet.
Watch out.
I've got a lot of friends who are keen to pick them up, but they've just been like, I need to buy so many more models now for this new style of army that they're facing the hobby lag pretty significantly.
If they had some transports before, I think you can make a case for 10 man units inside transports.
Yeah, I think with that codex, you can make a case for just about darn anything. Like,
fair point. But I mean, if they had 1 foot back in the pre-new codex, you can still really function, I think.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And it might even be the best build. I don't even know overlap. It's not the best. It could still be really the best.
Yeah, there 100% there is a lot of overlap. I mean, people were playing Bella last book. I mean, maybe some of them had more autocannons than las cannons in the last one, but I hear that's very easy to magnetize, that one, the las cannon and the autocannon change.
I don't know that it's easy to magnetize, but I've built the main model with plastic glue, and I've used super glue for that to pop it off later.
Good call. That's fair. But yeah, a lot of stuff in the old book. So, I mean, if you were playing Breach of Span, that's probably shifted. But you do have a pretty saucy army of renown if you want to lean into that rather than going for the new stuff. At least while you build up, you know, maybe what might be like a double or triple the amount of ranges or vanguard that you've got, and then the chicken walkers. But apart from that, I think the thing that people are probably going to want to do is buy another 5 or 10 infiltrators and rust stalkers, because those things got a mad lease on life.
Oh, you think so?
Yeah, I really do. I think they're...
Because I haven't built them into my current list.
Well, so I'm assuming people who've been playing through 8th edition and what we have in 9th edition, they probably have Sulphur Hounds, they have Taraxi, they probably have a lot of the new units. But then those old units, people who've picked up their game in 8th and 9th edition, like, they might not have any of the original, much of the original range, which is why I've heard people are struggling to get enough Rangers in Vanguard to play some of the lists that they want to play, because they need to literally triple the amount that they have. They have like 15 of each, and they need to now go to like, you know, some people want to go to 40 of each. Yeah, so they said they need to go out and triple them. And a lot of people who have stayed the course all the way through only have 5 infiltrators and 5 Rustalkers, because that's what you needed to do to make the war convocation when the armies were first launched. And now people want these guys, they want to be able to play with those models again, which is an incredible story, being like, hey, I haven't touched these guys since literally this formation went away at the start of 8th edition. It's been 4 years, I want to play with them now. And now, not only do I want to play with them, I want twice as many as I've got. I think that's really exciting.
Yeah, you can make a case for them, especially, and if people had them before, I know they were, if you had a big fat unit of them, I know they were a good target for Fury of Mars.
Yeah, that's true.
In the past, so some old-time players. Well, there isn't a bad build in this book, and I think whatever era you started, if you have some figures, you can roll them out with this codex, which I think is pretty elegant design, and it is powerful. Like, I'm not even going to front like it isn't. I think it's lethal.
Mm-hmm.
To where
you
need a little bit of terrain, you need a little bit of savviness. You know, I don't think this is an auto win against anything. I think you have to play it, and there's layers to the codex. And I've enjoyed experimenting with that. This is not an AdMech show, by the way. I did want to point out that anyone who's building Ironstriders out there, I sympathize what you're going through, and believe me, the journey is worth it because they rock.
Yeah, they absolutely slap, I hear.
but we were talking before. Well, actually, you know, let's actually, speaking of new models, let's just jump into it. Gaunt's Ghost coming out.
Oh, man.
Like, I know we talked about it before the lead up, but people are going to be getting them in their hands soon.
Not only that, but let me just say for everybody out there that limited edition stuff, I mean, there was a lot of consternation in the background, folks, that I was sweating it. And I'm sorry that I put everybody through that because I did. I was sweating.
We were your support group for the leading up to when the website updated.
Absolutely.
That's okay.
I was working through it, man. It had me on the I was on the ropes trying to make sure I got this. I really appreciate that GW added that queue list deal in. So like I spent all day Saturday just refreshing the page. I think
you started early.
I did start early because like in the UK it started at like 10 their time, which you know that's 5. For the East Coast, 5 in the morning, that's 3 in the morning for my time. And so I didn't know exactly how it was going to play out going forward. So I started at like 6 in the morning. I had some other work to do, but in the background, I was just constantly refreshing. And it wasn't until like 11 o'clock-ish, right? Finally, where it turned around. And so like that, but that queue list deal came up and I admit, I just... Because they're like, well, hey, here's the queue. You've got like 10 minutes and, you know, get stuff while it's available. And so, man, I admit, I just clicked all the anything with Gaunt on it.
Feverishly clicked.
Yep. Added to the cart and picked it up. And I'm really glad I can't wait to get that stuff.
So you got everything you ordered, everything you wanted.
Oh, man. Okay. So the models, of course, up front. But I got the limited edition books that are coming out. And then I also got the limited edition Crusade book, which is amazing. And the only thing I didn't happen to pick up that I'm probably coming back to is the bookmark. But yeah.
I was cheering if we had a soundtrack.
I was like white knuckled for you all morning. I was like, oh man, I hope he gets it.
I really do. That because I mean, I was clearly white knuckling it, so I really do appreciate that support.
I picked up the models because they will make awesome Catechin.
They will,
almost with no effort.
I mean, I'm gonna play them as Gaunt's Ghosts because changing them just seems like sacrilege.
I do love that you can, if you wanted to buy a couple of these, you could convert up just a swathe of amazing, like, build your own special characters out of it. I look at Bad Luck Brag and I see, like, a build your own Harker if you wanted to have that character in a non-Catechan aesthetic army. And, you know, Gaunt is just like whatever commissar you wanted. He's your dream commissar plus awesome camo cloak.
Actually, it's try again, Brag.
Oh, apologies. What'd I say? Bad luck, Brag. That's what you're going to call your Harker conversion.
Well, Red, I'm seriously, I'm glad you got it because I know this. There are some folks, you know, when you're out there trying to get this limited edition stuff, they're in demand and it can be a little stressful.
It is. It is stressful. And so I hope that everybody was able to get it if they wanted it. If you didn't, I'm sorry. I know that pain too of I still need to go out and get the Solar War map, the limited edition Solar War map. I know I'm just going to have to go to eBay and get it. But it's a thing for sure.
That thing was really pretty.
I saw someone frame their, was it palace map?
Yeah, yeah. It's my intention to do the same. I think that it's definitely worth that. It's very like high quality. It's very good. Totally worth doing that.
Yeah, absolutely agree. Cannot wait to do that. Get those up on the wall as well. You kind of have to. I mean, I feel like I have to get that stuff. I feel like I want it. I want that stuff, and I got. Anytime I see something that it could be art, you know, I got to grab it. I got to grab it.
Well, so that's, you know, with the Gaunt's Ghost deal and my move, I will get some pictures up. I need to finish a few more things in my setup. But with Gaunt's Ghost, I mean, so I've dug out my material is coming back out, starting to get my hobby back on. And I have about 5 boxes of IG vehicles and the things that, I mean, I have a ton of models right now that I need to figure out how to get it based. And so if you guys have any recommendations, I'm working through, I've got several of the old Tanith models. And I'm trying to get them into, I have, you know, some fancy bases. And they essentially, the way that the models are, you can't just, you know, they were originally made to be put into slotted bases, and I'm not doing that. And so for some of them, I have to pin them.
Oh, and I got a tip for that.
Give it to me, because I need it.
Are they on slotted bases to where they have their, like, there's that strip of metal that connects their feet?
Yes.
So
yes.
When you go to clip it, if you clip off the piece, you only need one little bit of metal. And so that one thin piece of metal that's under their foot, if you clip off the metal that's under the other foot and use that little thing, that little bit as the pin, you can use that. And that way you don't have to do actually pinning. You can use a Dremel or even you could use a drill or a hand drill.
Yeah.
To just put an eighth of an inch, I don't know. Whatever size it is, it's under the foot of one of those models.
Into the base, right? Just make a little divot or hole.
Mm. And then you just stick that thing on there, and that is your pin. I've done that with Death Company models for when I went switched them from 30 to from their 25s to 32s. Works like a charm. It's basically the cheapest, dirtiest, quickest pinning. Just using that tab.
Oh, that's great. Great recommendation.
I've done something similar, but I did it in fantasy, and I wasn't on heavy models, so that's why I thought I'd be able to get away with it. I didn't even consider you could do it on bigger models. But I used to just mask. I only had slotted bases squares, and I was just masking tape. All the piece of the slot that I wasn't going to use, just so I get a consistent coverage of my putty over it, and then just have the little piece that I just pushed the dude into with a little bit of glue. And that worked on smaller models, that worked a treat as well. But I think what Paul just said is way better for things of like marine size and terminators, etc.
I mean, provided you can drill into whatever material that you're putting them on as far as bases goes. But I mean, it's enough. I mean, with a little bit of super glue, it will hold them. I've never had a single Death Company or anything I've used that with fall off the base.
Brilliant. There is something, if you guys are finished with that, I don't want to segue us away too early, but I think a lot of us wanted this to happen. A lot of us said, oh, maybe it will, maybe it won't, and some people have dreaded it, but GW has confirmed we're getting Orc Boys for 40K.
What do y'all think about that?
We've seen some pictures. Yeah, we have seen I'm interested because I really like the newer aesthetic, I guess, as I mentioned. And so I'm interested.
I have some consternation from Orc friends that it's like, please don't be like way better looking than the current ones, because then I'm going to want to have to get them, and I'm going to have to get 100, 200 of them, and then I have to start over. Then I'm going to invalidate all these other awesome Orc Boys that I still like but don't look as good and blah 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 blah. And so I'm like, yeah, that's actually a pretty good point. You don't want, they want new Orc Boys, and they've been begging for new Orc Boys, but they want them to be about 50% better than the current ones.
Careful what you wish for.
300%. Exactly. But like 300% better than the current ones. So they stand out like, you know, proverbials on the battlefield, and people can obviously be like, oh well, these are the new ones, these are the old ones, and your army kind of looks off on the aesthetic. But I think I haven't looked at them now. It's only the head aesthetic has changed considerably, and we're seeing that much more, not goofy, much more like savage, bruiser, aggressive stance, like murderous face, rather than used to call the hooligan face, is what they kind of had previously. They're kind of a bit goofy. I suppose it's the inverse of what we saw Nurgle went through. Nurgle had the gruesome face, and now they've gone into the cartoony, cartoony face. Best example of that, look at Plague Toes, now look at the Beast of Nurgle. Those are the two kind of Nurgle aesthetics, and now we've got the kind of the goofy hooligan orcs from, you know, that came out and say they came out with, was it Black Reach they came out with, or was it prior to that?
Black Reach, I think, was the orc.
Yeah, it was Orc First Ultras, yeah. Right?
It's been a long time.
Yeah, yeah. So that was the box of 5th edition, wasn't it?
Sounds reasonable.
Someone maybe even been 4th edition. Someone will correct us. All I remember is the Crash Thunderhawk terrain, which I thought was sweet. No, and
it's Aquila Lander.
Oh, sorry.
Womp womp.
Edit it out. No, whatever.
That'll still stay. Don't worry.
No one on this show has been listening for that long. Most of the people on this show have been listening for that long. I liked everything else this did. The pants look the same. Hell, even the steel cap boots and the shoulder pads look the same. The shooter looks the same. It's just really probably the stance, the cast of it. Maybe they're not so hunched over anymore. I'm really interested to see how they come out. What do you guys think?
I like the drips and drabs we're getting from the orcs, with seemingly going to be, a lot of models, similar to what we've seen with some of these other codecs, like the Sisters and stuff, getting just to tons of a raft of new releases.
So as an Orc player, I'm going to say that I think that the new Orc Boy is an awesome upgrade to what they had before, but I think it was a mistake releasing it so close to the Age of Sigmar Aurochs, because those Age of Sigmar models just look way cooler.
Oh. I'm talking about the Cruels or whatever they're called.
Yeah, right? They're just so cool. So then I see this, which it's all right, the new Orc Boy, but it's not those Cruel Boys.
That's funny. It's kind of hard not to look at the Age of Sigmar, what they're doing with the models and how they're continuing to redefine their world and have unique take on the fantasy setting. And I like that it's more differentiated from the sci-fi 40K world set.
Mm. The Cruel Boys look absolutely phenomenal. I really like the aesthetic. I like the swampy, dirty, grimy orc aesthetic. I think it's fantastic. I think they pulled it off perfectly. The other new thing that came out, and this might be some of the more lore heads, but Argyll freaking Tarl's getting a model.
Okay, and what a model. How big is that model?
I think he's huge. I think he's so ginormous.
I mean, I've got, and they are in various states of being assembled, but because I think that they're some of the best. Definitely talk about like a model update. I've got probably 20 Galvor back, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's an amazing piece. Talk about like with his wings and everything, a smash captain or something like that. I mean, that's just an amazing model to put on the table. I can't wait to actually physically see it, because I'm blown away by it. It's and Argyll Tarl in the books, it's just one of the, it's hard to argue. I think he is one of the better characters of the Horus Heresy in general.
Absolutely. Absolutely. He's in my top three favorite characters.
Got to be careful here. I don't want to have any spoilers, because the character does have a great story and would not want to shortchange anybody who is not.
I appreciate that. Thank you so much. I feel like every time you guys start talking about lore, I'm like, I haven't got there yet.
If I 10 years down yet, that's fine.
Well, seeing that they made the model for him, you kind of know where things are going for him, given what he looks like.
No spoilers, Red.
Yeah.
I can't help it. Look at him. What do you think? He just had a walk in the park?
He's definitely a loyalist.
Been through some rough times. He's been through some rough times. He's definitely going to have knee issues.
That ultramarine had his base had it coming. Yeah. Is it a lieutenant? Is it a lieutenant?
It has base? To be.
Oh, please be. Please, someone please come out and tell me that's a lieutenant. That's like one of the first ultra lieutenants.
They have much different names in 30K. I'm sorry.
It'd be a centurion, yeah. A couple of things came out here. Some people came out and said, why isn't he equipped with his thematic lore weapons? Because he actually wields a custody spear in the lore.
Oh my goodness. And Adam cannot not spoil.
What am I not spoiling? How did he get it?
Oh, you're definitely not spoiling.
Champion, yeah. But some people pointed out he's not wielding it. Some people scratched their head as to why. And a lot of people came back and said, I just don't think. When you look at that model, do you not think he would look silly if he had a spear in his hand?
I didn't even think about that, because I'm just so enraptured by how just mega mega awesome this model. I didn't even think that.
Yeah,
that's fair. Totally fair. I mean, I suppose this just shows some of the things I roll with, but all the people I'm in contact with, they look at these things and they pick. And the other exciting one was that's the very first time we've ever had a Mark II plastic model. If that is a plastic model or a Mark II in a new CAD of a Mark II being produced by GW, because that guy looks a lot better and a lot different to the Mark IIs that have come out previously. I'm talking about the dead guy. He's holding
you. Yeah, yeah. I get you. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that's fun to think about.
Does that mean we're gonna get new Mark II sculpts, and everyone's really excited?
That's fun to speculate on for sure. And I love the paint job is doing it justice too. Like this thing is when if you know about the character and you see it, I'm like, yeah, that's what's up.
Mm. So maybe this is up to Paul. Maybe it's a decent thing to close on. What are your three favorite characters?
In the Heresy or just in general?
Your choice.
That's a good question.
See, we'll go with the Heresy. We'll make it. We'll give it some context.
Raldron.
Or duh. Sorry, continue.
Well, so I'm going to say non-Primarch characters, because I think that's really what we want, right?
Also, yeah.
No, what were you saying?
I was going to say, I've had this conversation with quite a few people, and usually a Primarch doesn't make people's top five. And I think it's because Primarchs aren't relatable. We as human beings reading and consuming the
maybe
knowledge.
Your Primarch's not, not relatable.
He's not Ferris. Jeez. No, sorry.
My Primarch is awesome. Do you, this is an aside. Do you know Primarch's not a real word?
Yeah, it was invented for this one, wasn't it?
Yeah. So I think it might have been like a decade ago. I'm like having a normal conversation with someone. Like, you know, it's like a Primarch. And they're like, what on earth are you talking about?
That's hilarious.
No, I was like, oh, weird. Alien dude? Like, what? I smell some heresy over here. What do you mean you don't know how to relate?
But you know, it's like a genetically engineered super soldier is like built from the gene code of a god, you know, like Primarch.
Yeah. And it's a D&D monster with like wings and tentacles. So, you know, it could be either one of those things, but they didn't know either. And so I feel like this nerd rage is justified. Yeah. One of the Orfeo is one of my favorite characters, which is a throwaway character. He's actually an ultramarine. I shouldn't say throwaway character. There are no throwaway characters. It's a character that I don't think makes it out of one book, but has such a presence, and I think it was just written so well that I really love that character.
Brilliant. So you got Raeldron, this dude. Sorry, I forgot his name already.
Orfeo. He's an ultramarine. And I know I mentioned this before, but he basically is dominating the world eaters in combat so much that they have to send Angron after him.
Fair.
And I thought that was just pretty awesome.
Pick number three.
That's a hard one. Now we're starting to get into the, like, there's actually a ton of competition for second and then a ton of competition for third. And I'm almost afraid to say third.
Feel free to dodge it if you want. We can hand pass to Red or Tanya.
Come back to me. Come back to me. If no one says it, I'll say it.
All right. Red or Tanya, who wants to go next?
Tanya, I think you got it.
Well, I've only read, I think, like 13 books in the Horus Heresy, but
it's not bad.
So far, it's Nathaniel Garrow.
Okay, good choice.
Probably Ahriman.
Okay, great choice.
And Garviel Loken.
Oh, nice.
In that order?
Okay.
Yeah.
That's a good trio. Absolutely. Yeah, smashed it. Nice. All right, I got nothing to say there. That's almost perfect.
Yeah, Red, what you got?
All right, so mine aren't necessarily in this order because I've been thinking about
it.
For a second.
You have to order them. That was Adam's specific request.
It's the mandate.
So, man, in order is tough. I really like Sejitar, if I'm saying it right. The Prince of Crows, essentially Conrad Curse's second in command.
Oh,
kind of
that
guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, Sevitar.
Yeah, awesome. Sevitar, sorry. Yeah, so I really like his back and forth. Still, I mean, I thought there's a lot to their whole thing between the Sin Eaters and how he kind of his whole character plays itself out. Again, without any spoilers or anything, I just think he's a really good character to follow, especially as the story we know clearly from the books as they've come out, as the Night Lords end up having to fight the Dark Angels and how Sevitar kind of takes things. I thought it was quite remarkable. I really like the Night Lords as a legion have kind of just this kind of overhanging tragedy, much like some other legions, Paul, that clearly afflicted them.
No tragedy over here.
Yeah. Yeah. Sanguinius isn't the Lord of the Imperium right now, is he?
Technicalities.
I mean, Dante did get the other half of the
smaller half.
The
smaller half.
Smaller part. Yeah, the cut off, starved version of it. Yeah.
Gilliman broke the biscuit in half and he gave the crumbs.
So I think that Loken kind of comes as a package, right? Because I think that those first heroes introduced, like Saul Tarvitz and Targaryen, I think that those were some pretty remarkable deals. And I think that Loken kind of ties all that together. And so I think he's a great bridge character between things. So I'll go Sevitar, Loken, and then this is not fair.
I told you it's tough, right?
No. This one, because really this is my first, and I know that there's some people that have heard me go on about it. And this is, it's really tough because of just the book itself. So I really like, out of the Perpetuals, I really like, I'm trying to remember his name because I keep thinking of him in his other state.
John Grammaticus?
No, not Grammaticus. The one that's the other one.
Oleanus Pius?
Yes. Yeah. Right. So he's got different names, right? And he kind of starts out as that. I can't spoil it. I'm sorry, Tanya. I won't spoil it. But out of the Perpetuals, he's probably up there. And then I have to say, as like the honorable mention, I know you said not Primarchs and everything, but I'm actually, as far as how the Emperor has been portrayed in the Horus Heresy and into the Siege of Terra, I can't, man.
Red's found a loophole.
He's too good. He's too good. Like the character and the myth and everything that's attached to him. And then like when he does demonstrate his like human connections to people, for all that, you know, there's what was the name of that one book? The Dead.
Outcast Dead.
Outcast Dead. Oh my gosh.
That book is underrated, severely underrated.
Severely. And there are these times throughout all of the Horus Heresy and whatnot where the Emperor is this aspect of himself, right? Because, you know, as we've seen, he's this to someone, he's this to someone else, whatever. But this man, like that The Last Church book. You didn't like that one, Tanya?
Oh, I loved that one.
That's what I'm talking about, right? Like, there's so much to it that, like, when you're reading stuff like Gaunt's Ghost or Eisenhorn or a lot of just the different material, and something like if you read Vengeful Spirit and some of the material that comes with just how you see what the just different gleanings of the Emperor, it is just amazing. And he's such a good enigmatic character that to see him like suddenly be human for a moment, it's crazy. It just blows my mind, and I love capturing just those little bits and slowly putting it together. The book about more or less about him on Terra, Master of the Imperium, Master of Mankind.
Yeah, Master of Mankind.
Master of Mankind. There's so much to it. There's just too good. And I love it, and I love the way that they get portrayed. I regret that there's not a... There are some good Iron Warrior characters, but there aren't any that unfortunately stick out to my mind. There are some good ones, but they don't stick out as well. And they did a good job with some of the Horus Heresy material of Iron Warrior characters and how they carried forward into the 40K Iron Warrior books. But they just don't stick out as the ones that I've mentioned, like Sevatar and Loken for sure. Being, you know, you mentioned Nathaniel Garrow. I think that he's another iconic Horus Heresy character throughout.
Garrow and Loken, who I had in my mind tied for third. And I feel like they are a lot of go-tos, but because they're so awesome. Like, they're both extremely awesome and well-done
quite
characters.
Heroic. Yeah.
So I'll go in with my third as Nakona Sherrigan from the Raven Guard.
Yeah, that's a good one.
I'm on record of loving that character, and I think it's just the what they've put that character up against and the way that the characters conducted themselves in those various situations, I think is another incredibly well done. But they're thinking, this is an unfair question. We've been put in a no-win scenario.
Yeah, thanks, Adam.
This is a great topic.
Just because of the masterful way that some of these characters have come to life on the page, and that their stories aren't over yet.
It's interesting to see how the Siege of Terra is progressing. I'm not crazy up to date, like I don't know what happens in Mortis and et cetera, but it's really interesting to see how much. It must be such a problem for the authors of the Siege of Terra, because they have such this. They've got 20 years of stories that have already been written about so many of the characters that they have to write about now, that they're under such constraints about what these characters can and can't do in the story. That I feel like it must be such a headache.
Dude, just get caught up. We'll talk about it after the last book. It's hit the shelves and people have caught up. Well, maybe that's it. Maybe we need to have like a book club show to where we go over some of this stuff so no one has to hear it if they aren't caught up.
That'd be a good idea. Just doing like a 20-minute, half hour. Everybody, this month we're reading this book from the Heresy, and then we're going to talk about it for half an hour on the show or something. That'd be cool.
Well, I think, look, we're out of time this week, everybody.
It ran away with us this time.
No, that's a good, that was a great question, and I think we barely scratched the surface. I don't know, Adam, did you give us your top three?
Nah, I touched it.
You got to do it. You got to put yourself through this agony.
I was just kind of being aloof and see how many people in the comments caught up on it. But in the comments, chuck down your top three as well, please, or send it through to Paul or whatnot, and we'll talk about them on the next show maybe. But my three, Khan, like World Eaters Khan. I find him immensely complex. His duality of having to be a savage warrior, a leader, but also the foil for Angron, and to manage the expectations of his legion, at times being a sole commander of the entire force because Angron is Angron. I find him incredibly intriguing. Ahriman, for similar reasons, his conflicted nature going against his father, but also being somebody trying to be something of a savior. And then I was going to pick Sigismund, but then I realized Sigismund. The bits of Sigismund that I love are his bits in the Black Legion novels when he fights about it. That's my favorite bit, and that's not in Horus Heresy, so I'm not going to pick it. So my third one's actually Argal Tarl. I'm going to go Argal Tarl as my third.
Okay.
I didn't give any craps about word bearers. I did not care about them, did not know them, did not care to know them. There was no interest there because of how they've been portrayed in 40K. That one character made me care about the whole Legion, their whole story, and everything that they did, and made me want to know more. And I feel like that inspiration deserves the third spot.
I think that's a great point. I think that I admit, like, Karn, and I'm sure there's people that thought that I was going to say Karn right out the gate. I think you're right. I don't know in the relationship between those two, Karn and Argal Tarl, is fantastic. And so I won't go any further into that. But the writing between it and what it drags out, and how, again, you know, we talked about this with other parts of the Horus Heresy, but how it really, a lot of the books make concrete just what we've talked about in a very aloof fashion of what was happening during the Horus Heresy. And to make such a concrete thing of what Karn was like and what he had to deal with and what the word bearers were going through and whatnot, it's pretty remarkable. And I love the little engagements. I really love the arguments between the legions and how they were going about the crusade or even the heresy itself. And even to the point, you know, like the conversations between the world eaters and how they were managed, it's remarkable.
And I put the writing between those two legions during the Shadow Crusade and the storyline therein, I put it up there with the best of ADB's work. You know, ADB made us care about Night Lord's characters. Literal psychopathic monsters.
Yeah,
and we gave a crap about them. Same, and I think it's been overlooked, but the same thing happened with Khan and Argal Tarl. They made us care about literally genocide. I fell in love with dudes who were performing genocide. I didn't feel good about it, but that's what happened. They were literally like genociding the planets of Ultramar, and I was falling in love with the characters at the same time. And I was just like, this is amazing writing. These are amazing characters.
Where's the commissar? Someone get the commissar.
This is not the first time this episode he has spout heresy.
Oh my god!
That's what I'm here for, guys. That's what I'm here for. But yeah, thanks for letting me point that out. Because yeah, hopefully people relate to that stuff. And please check
for self-identifying, Adam.
Well, I can't. But, thank y'all for.
I was talking about what a feat of character and what a feat of writing it was to make me care about these characters whilst writing about these horrific things that they were partaking in.
I'd also like to point out that opinions expressed on this show are of the sole individuals. Thanks for everybody for coming along with this discussion, the topics that we have. We covered a wide range of things. We went from, you know, kind of grindy tournament talk to some of the absolute highest echelons of the lore that we've got for this game, and we love it. And really appreciate y'all coming with us. We'll see
y'all
next week.
Thanks for me. See ya.
See you, everybody.
I don't know what they said, but I already subscribed. You better do it too.